VC 站是 Evan。Our top management and from the our two judges, the Supreme Court of Appeal President Judge Howie and our retired Judge Friedman. To make our life even easy, Dr. Friedman, Judge Friedman, presented to the committee the proposed amendment to the very famous Clause 11. And again, to Clauses 17, 29, 38, we just received the proposed amendment to those clauses from Dr. Miller. Now, what we're going to do, I want us to consider those proposals, but I want us to start with Clause 11. Just to hear colleagues say, what are you saying about the proposed amendment from Dr. Friedman? No. What am I saying? Judge Friedman. Now, unless if you want us to give the department just to talk to those amendments, but if members want to come in now, I can give you a chance to come in now. Just hear the department's view, even though the buck stops with your colleagues, if you're going to accept those amendments or not. But I think it would be good at the same time to hear the department as to whether the proposed amendments, are they accommodative enough? You know, what the message that was conveyed to us, that was clear, is that, by the way, if this bill or this particular clauses are challenged to the Constitutional Court, the message you got to say is that the people are going to sit and decide on the constitutionality of these clauses are the judges themselves who one day are going to retire. That was a serious statement that we're not going to take it light. You know? I don't want to say it was a threat, but it was cautioning us about it. Now, do you want to come in now or must I give the department first to respond? I see Dr. Manero wants to come in. Let me start, Dr. Van Herden, Honorable Ntuli, Honorable Leroux, Darrell, in that order.
Chairperson, I actually was under the impression that we are not going to deliberate on that. I'm ready to come in, but I left my documentation in my office because on my program it's the Justice and Constitutional Development Judicial Education Bill that's being discussed today. But I think if we are going to deliberate on yesterday's bill, I'm ready, just that I do not have the documentation before me. But I think it's very important that we come to some sort of a conclusion in that regard. Thank you.
Yeah, because I want your full participation with having all the information. I wouldn't mind if and ask the secretary to bring those documents. I don't mind. We can apply go slow, you know, until. Thanks for accommodating us. Honorable Ntuli.
Thanks, Chairperson. I would like to second Dr. Van Herden. I was also of the view that we were going to do the South African Judicial Education Institute. I was also thinking that we'll start with that one. But on your question whether we allow the department to deliberate, I think it will be a good idea because I think as the members, we're supposed to take a decision after we have been advised by our legal advisors whether are we still on the right track. So I'll support that we let the department take us through first, or our legal advisors to take us through before we deliberate on it. Thanks.
Darren?
Yes, I also haven't got my documents. I think it would be a very good idea if the department do go through it, because having seen these amendments, that's one thing, but how that would tie in, you know, the actual wording. There might be an amendment or an adjustment necessary there. And then there's two phases to this bill. Of course, there's Dr. Milo's recommendation with regard to the judges, the college. And then there's the other part, of course, of the judges.
Chairperson, just on the judges that will judge themselves, I thought it was more said in lighter vein than anything like a serious threat. The people that are dressed up are fairly serious people, and they would not fall into such a silly trap as to put the whole judiciary in a bad light to say that the judges will not be able to give a fair hearing because they are involved themselves. So I would like us to treat that as more in jest than really a threat. And I think also I'll agree with you, let the department give their views on the Dr. Milo's insertion as well as ex-Judge Friedman's input.
Parliamentary advisor Refilo, I wonder if you were fully briefed by a colleague so that they can give us expert advice on the same provisions. But I'll call you later after the department, because this one, when I must know that we are on our side, not on Johan's side. So that's why. Okay, no, fine. Johan, can you talk to the submissions by our esteemed judges, please?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just to make it clear, I'm actually on nobody's side. I'm one true independent participant in some of the chair. Seriously, I want to take the committee back briefly to the meeting in Potchefstroom, where I think Mr. Lehu asked the department if there can be some statistics with regard to the applications that's been made. And using that as a starting point, Chair, I've been able to look at all applications made by retired judges since 1994 up to September 2006. So the only outstanding part is really 2007. Now, during that period, 44 retired judges made applications to the minister. All of those applications were granted. It amounted to a number of, if we bear in mind that one judge could have made more than one application, the total number of applications, not the judges, but the applications for matters where this permission to do extrajudicial work amounted to 280 altogether. So there were 280 individual instances where permission was granted. Arbitrations formed the vast majority of those applications, a total of 197 applications. And just as a result of what was said yesterday, I checked very briefly, since 2005, sorry, and I used 2005 because there was referred to the Sloppy report on racism, and that arbitration would have taken a knock since that report. And I just counted from 2005 to September 2006, there were 37 applications granted which referred to arbitrations. So it is not as if arbitrations all of a sudden were ceased to give permission. That is just the starting point, Chair. Chair, secondly, it's difficult for me because I think the committee and the members are now really experts, because they've had some intensive deliberations on the whole dispensation of judges. So I might be boring in some respects, and please stop me if I repeat myself. myself or if I say things that you already know too well. Chair, and with respect, just to say that the arguments we've heard yesterday, or that I've heard rather, yesterday, and I'm excluding the argument, the presentations by Dr. Miller, was nothing new. It's been said again and again and again. And it is something for this committee to decide, that issue of Clause 11, where to draw the line, if there should be a line at all. Judge Friedman's proposal, I'm very sorry, this was considered, although it did not emanate from him, but in many earlier versions of this legislation, a similar proposal was considered. And I really cannot take the matter further than pointing out that what you have in front of you at the moment in Clause 11 was the result of thorough deliberations, and it's really up to this committee to decide whether they agree with it or not, and whether they feel that there could be any improvements on it or not. Personally, I thought there might be... It would appear that what on the face of it seems objectionable is the perception being created by the current wording that it's a prohibition. And we might consider looking at the wording to make it clear that it's not really a prohibition on doing extrajudicial work for remuneration. It's rather a qualification. And one way of achieving that shift in perception could be to say that the minister must grant permission unless the minister and chief justice is satisfied that, and then we look to those factors in 11 that say if those factors are present, then you may not grant the permission. So you could really just make it a qualification that you must apply, you must get written permission, and the permission must be granted unless there is very clear reasons. Object of test, the minister and the chief justice must be satisfied that it will be detrimental to the judiciary, etc., 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 etc. That's a possibility. It would not change anything in practice, but it would deal with a negative perception that's apparently arisen in this regard. I cannot really take that further, Chair, and I'm looking forward to your deliberations on this issue. Chair, then, with regard to Dr. Miller's representation, I think the issue was very briefly raised in an earlier deliberation by this committee. This is the issue of whether the formal inquiries by the conduct tribunal and in some instances by the conduct committee would take place in public or not. And a thought occurred to me yesterday that even though the Magistrates Commission, or in terms of the rules applicable to magistrates' disciplinary hearings, public access is in fact allowed in certain of the formal inquiries. It is interesting that when the recommendation eventually reaches Parliament as to the impeachment or not of the magistrate, both in this House and in the National Assembly, I need not remind members that those meetings take place in camera. That's one of the exclusions where everybody is not free to attend the committee meeting. So that it's just interesting to note that. And I suppose it's also a bit of an anomaly if, when it comes to magistrates specifically, the earlier stages can take place in public, but when it reaches Parliament and the consideration of impeachment, then it's not a public, not being dealt with in public anymore. I did, however, do some research, and I must apologize, there was, of course, very limited time at my disposal. And it is in fact correct that in terms of the Canadian laws, as they are, I'm referring to the Canadian Judges Act, and they've got bylaws under the Act, those inquiries, the formal stage of the inquiry, does in fact take place in public. I'm not sure if it's Section 6 or Regulation 6. It says any hearing of the inquiry committee shall be conducted in public unless, subject to Section 63(6) of the Act, the Inquiry Committee determines that the public interest and the due administration of justice require that all or any part of a hearing be conducted in private. And that is interesting how they've just swapped that around. In this case, public interest and due administration of justice require that it's not in public. And then they continue to say the Inquiry Committee may prohibit the publication of any information or documents placed before it, if it determines that publication is not in the public interest. I've come across one other instance, one of the states in the United States of America where these inquiries are also taking place in public. But I was not able to find other examples. From some of the cases that's already being dealt with already by this Canadian Judicial Council, it also appeared that this was quite a bone of contention in some instances where they've actually instituted these inquiries, and that the respondent, the judge in that case, in some instances took the matter to the courts to say, but this should not be this public access. And the argument is almost not necessary for me to repeat them to you. It's so obvious, and it's been briefly referred to yesterday, that the irreparable damage that you can do to a person's reputation if these allegations are being made and you get a trial by media, and afterwards it turns out that the allegations were unfounded, but the damage has then been done. So that is just one thing, or I suppose some of the things that the committee would take into account. But also in that regard, I cannot really take the matter further. It is really a policy matter that you should be considering whether one should adopt a different approach in this regard. It was interesting that the judges that were present here did not respond to this. Of course, bearing in mind that one is already has been discharged from active service, and the other one will be discharged from active service soon. And in our experience, the judges are also very hesitant to speak on behalf of their colleagues. They would obviously like to confer firstly before bringing out a view in this regard. But unless there's specific questions, I'm afraid that is as far as I can take you.
Thanks, Mr. Delange, for talking to the proposed amendments. I flew high because I simply assumed they were brought up in the meeting. For those who are not here, the bill, the chosen question is where retired judges would be expected to ask permission from the minister when they are to perform an other duty after they have retired. So they are objecting to that saying because they are no more in the employ of the state. They are not expected to ask permission if they are to do other duties outside. The argument again is the notion of the judge for life, that disputing that there's nothing like the judge for life, that was only a sentiment by the late Minister Koriko Tsie. There's no such. Now, it's up to us. Now, I'm doing this deliberately because we want to make sure as this house that whatever is done by our colleague in the NA, that's why there is this senior house that to make sure that if there are some things that were not properly considered by our colleague, it's up to this house to look into those and decide accordingly. That's the crux of the matter. The other provisions in the bill, those are normal things, even though we are going to propose amendments here and there, but that are not contentious or that are not substantial. Now, we heard from the department. I think it will be, before we ask any questions to Johan, let me hear Phil. So, Phil, talk to us when I is.
Thank you, Chair. I probably am just about to commit suicide in that Mr. Vanara hadn't told me as well that this matter would be considered today. So what I'm going to be saying is qualified, and it's based on discussions that I had with him on the matter. Firstly, Chair, he had indicated that he was going to give the committee a written opinion. Which will be probably better for the committee to rely on than what I'm about to say in a few seconds. My view, Chair, is that firstly, this is me moving from the assumption that or the belief rather, that the judge's submission was based on Section 22 of the Constitution, the freedom of trade, occupation, and profession, that this clause limits or rather takes away their rights, contravenes their rights. And my view, Chair, is that no right in the Bill of Rights is absolute. All the rights are subject to Section 36, the Limitation Clause. And much as everybody does have, every citizen does have a right to choose a trade, occupation, and profession, that right is limited by Section 36. And unless it can be said that the limitation, which is the clause, which will be a limitation to that right, unless it can be said that it's not or it's unreasonable and unjustifiable in an open and democratic society, then it will be a limitation, a valid limitation in terms of Section 36. And looking at the clause, specifically sub 3, which limits the circumstances under which the minister may refuse permission to the retired judges, I would argue that it is a valid limitation in terms of Section 36. I would argue that the limitation is not arbitrary and it doesn't take away the right completely, because they will only deny permission if whatever the judge intends to be involved in adversely affects the efficiency or effectiveness of the administration of justice, which I want to believe that judges are not intending to do, adversely affect the image or reputation of the administration of justice, in any manner undermines the legal framework which underpins the judge for life concept, results in the judge engaging in any activity that is in conflict with the vocation of a judge, bring the judiciary into disrepute or have a potential to do so. And those are the circumstances, the only circumstances under which the minister may deny permission for a retired judge or a judge that is not in active service to undertake any work or service. I am sure that's what Mr. Van Nara's opinion is going to argue, that yes, it is a limitation, but it is a valid limitation in terms of Section 36. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much, Mr. Shura, for talking to the submission. There was a question by the judges yesterday. The question was to the effect that what mischief are we trying to curb from judges? The mischief. What mischief are we trying to curb by this legislation? And I wanted to respond to that at the same time to talk to their submission as what do you think about their submission, the proposed amendments to the same. Didn't get it. No.
Could I just ask you something? Are we sitting without that Friedman
This one page thing.
Yeah, we're not having that in our hands.
What are you doing to me now?
It was handed out here, so
even yesterday it was handed out yesterday.
Yeah.
The one page.
We didn't know we were going to discuss it this morning, so we didn't bring it.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
You can just make up some of that.
Okay. But maybe colleagues, maybe I'm unfair to you if I want to discuss this thing thoroughly, if I don't have this document.
This is the important document here, but it just be exactly what Judge Friedman said.
Can you provide members with this thing? Yeah, unless I was not clear, like yesterday, I said we were going to discuss this thing and the other bill. That's what I said yesterday. Mm-hmm. That we're going to discuss this bill, and from there and discuss the social education bill. But I take your point. You can't discuss without
that.
I take your point, madam. Yeah, this one page proposal amendment from Judge Friedman. Can we make copies for for members. And my apologies, I thought they were arriving at colleagues. My apologies. Yeah, I was just trying to deal with the mischief. They were so vocal about it, they are afraid. I'm sure Vanara told you. But when you see judges, I see these people who are so mischievous. What is that we're trying to do, you know, but judges who are so respectable, you know? Huh? Boss, talking about judges, Doc?
Chairperson, are you going to allow me to respond to our researcher's interpretation of Section 36?
I will.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, because I want them to talk to these questions before I allow you. Because I allow them to clear this thing. I want them to exhaust their arguments, and then we'll come to deal with them.
I did say, Chair, that I'm probably opening myself up to dangers, and I probably shouldn't have. But Chair, and again, I haven't seen the submissions that were made. Like I said, my opinion, which is a very qualified one, is based on discussions that I had with Vanara. I haven't seen any the submissions that the judges made, and I haven't seen the proposed amendment. And the department would probably speak better to the mischief they're trying to address. But again, my understanding was that what they're trying to avoid. The department would speak better. Let me not go there. The department would speak better on the mischief they're trying to address.
Before Johan comes in, Doc wanted to respond to what you said directly. Can I allow Dr. Van Herden to talk to that?
Okay, listen, I've got such a lot of things on my mind. I hate to agree with Johan over there in respect of the openness and the transparency of disciplinary hearings against judges. Chairperson, I do still from time to time do appear before judges, and I wouldn't like to be part of any discussion, and you and me are part of the Judicial Services Commission. I was one of the persons actually who... I was actually the person, and I was blamed by some of my colleagues, particularly your colleague, that I actually raised this issue. I don't want to be part of any discussion of a judge before I may appear in future. So I fully agree with Mr. De Longa. Dr. Emilio made a very good submission, but I am very hesitant to follow his line. But I actually would like to get back to our researcher's interpretation of the limitation clause. Chairperson, it must be one of general application. And now I'm going to give you one example, Chairperson. Section 36 says that it must be a law of general application. It therefore means, Chairperson, that suppose we retire as members of Parliament with full remuneration or full pension equal to our salary. It means that if you take that as your point of departure, it means then, Chairperson, that if you retire with full pension, you cannot ever enter politics again, be that as a councillor, be that as someone in the legislature, unless you have the permission of maybe the Secretary of Parliament or the President of the country, which is really, Chairperson, that is a conclusion. That's not general application. If that is a law of general application, and with great respect, that limitation clause regarding the general application of such a law will definitely not stand scrutinization by any constitutional court. Again, it's ridiculous to think that any member of Parliament who retires must get permission before he or she stands after retirement again for any representative position. That's one example. Another example, and and let me also be frank about this, Judge Schlorpy isn't my favorite judge. But I think if he wants to sell wine, well, that's again my, that's another thing. I don't want to preempt what the minister is going to say. But I think, I just another matter, if a judge, for instance, buys and sells cars, because he likes cars and he likes to sell it, does it mean that he needs to get permission to buy and sell cars? But I would rather like to move to another example of general application. If an engineer retires from Eskom and he now starts developing a generator and sells a generator, does it mean that he needs to get permission from the whoever that is, the Minister of Mineral and Energy Affairs, to do that? This matter of permission isn't, in my opinion, anything that will stand the scrutinization of constitutionality. And then finally, Chairperson, Judge Friedman, and I'm not going to refer to the retired Judge Friedman, because they retain the title as judges, like even professors who retire retain their titles as professors. I'm not a professor. It says here, and he provides for that in section 11, in the proposed amendment 11.3, which I think, he said that a judge who has been discharged, and I'm just going to, may not hold or perform any office of profit or receive any fees or emoluments in respect of any service other than those referred to in subsection 2, which refers to arbitration and commissions act and so on. And then again, without the consent of the consent in writing, and that's important, of the minister who may grant such consent, only if the minister acting in consultation with the Chief Justice is satisfied that the granting of such consent will not in any way adversely affect the integrity of the judiciary or the country. In short, Chairperson, to round up, I think that this is a submission, or rather a proposed amendment, that we should look in seriously in the first place. In the second place, I'm still very uneasy about hearing complaints against judges in the open in open in an open hearing. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. Can I recognize them? Who is next? It's Honorable Leroux and then Honorable Mzee.
Oh, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much also for this, Chairman. I just think we had two very eminent judges, and we had Paul Hoffman as a senior advocate, all telling us that if we don't change Clause 11, there will be a constitutional challenge to the law. And I think we as a committee must take that very, very serious. And I agree with that. The judges are not judges for life. It was a quasi-cutious nonsense that is causing all this trouble now. And I agree also with Frick that if we, and that's what we're fighting for after 15 years of service in Parliament, we want a full salary. Then we'll be in the same position. Anything we want to do, we must now go and ask the minister. That cannot be constitutionally right. Because everybody, according to 22 in the Constitution, has the right to apply his trade. Not to go and ask the minister, to apply his trade. So I think we will be challenged, and I think we must take it very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Leroux. Honorable Mzuzi. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think I was loud and clear yesterday that when we come to section 11, sub 2 and 3, I need a very convincingly statement that will remove any doubt that there is an intention to presuppose that the judges will be doing something very sinister. In that, if there was any evidence, which evidence was cited was of that of Judge Schlorpy, which we do not know,
what the minister or whoever is hearing that, what would be the outcome. And over and above, Judge Shope is not a retired judge. He's still young. He's a young boy. He's not even my age. He's still active. That's something else. We cannot even bring it to those who are now retired. Dr. Van Heerden cited a very interesting issue about Parliament, which we all envy, that we would like to retain our status of salaries. But let me go beyond that. Our case, if we have that, and those who will be coming thereafter, they will also be getting increase, and the salaries will change from time to time. But we don't fall in that category. That if changes do come, that the people are now getting these, there are increase, then our salaries will increase. Ours would remain where I am till then. But with the judges, it is said, I don't know if probably we misquoted that, that if any changes takes place of their remuneration, emolument, or whatever you're saying, theirs will also keep on, it's alive right through. I think that's where the difference is. And therefore, when I say I need a very convincing statement to change from that premise, I'm flexible. And I don't want to give an impression that judges that were here yesterday, they did not make a very good input and they expressed their opinion openly, and we should actually take it into account when we deliberate. But Section 11, I don't think there's anything sinistic that we're hiding. When we talk of the administration, it's purely on the basis that if we say, okay, we open the floodgate, that, for instance, Dr. Van Heerden is an advocate, and he will die as an advocate. Even if he gets out of parliament, he will still go to court and argue. He will be requested to do anything. But the problem that we are facing is that if we open the floodgate, judges that are still active in the practice would say, hey, if others can do the same, let me retire and go and do the same. Oh, let's all have the same thing, because you're not a judge born as a judge. You're a judge by going through as an attorney, you advocate, we consider you as a person who's above everything, then become a judge. And it is in that concept that we say, let us now jeopardize the administration, because everybody will be then going for that. The refusal that might probably come, it would be very absurd if the refusal would be based on the color, it would be based on the back window of the apartheid, if the door is white, you cannot watch it. I think the argument would be that if the minister would say, I don't say it will, if the minister says, yes, you will be requested by, we assume they will be requested to do some work. And the minister said, no, what they have requested from you, I do have active judges that can do that. It is probably not necessary for you to go and do that, because I have people who are still on the bench to do that. I think that would be the argument for us, that to say, remove if. It is the basic, if it is based on the maximum just refusal, that will be taken. I think the bill says, if it becomes law, that they can challenge it. That why do you do that? I think the access to information actually does allow that. So I don't think we would dwell much. Those are the things. But coming to other arguments, I think I take the point where they say there's nothing like a lifetime judge. Yes, the concept says that, but when your remuneration goes on, then you become alive. And also, when they say the judge is discharged, they've got a valid point. Yes, you're discharged from service. And I think then, the argument would be then, I am now discharged, but I still want to practice. That would be something else. Then we can look into that. But if the discharge is because we don't say the person can be discharged by looking at the person, and we look at the age, we look at the wisdom, the burden that person may face, then we say, all right, you are now being discharged. And I don't think like there is a Chuck Holmes. We said he can't even go and sell, but then finish us. I'm now retired and I'm discharged and I'm happy. But others, if there's intention of going to do some other practice, we don't say they're going to sell gold or anything, but solely they will be requested to go and to be commissioned. They will be requested to go and do. We once know you are good. Then we want you to go and do that. Those are some of the arguments that I have. Unless I'm convinced.
This discussion reminds me of the sexual offences bill, how it was so intense and what else. Can I recognize the Honorable Ntuli?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think it will be better if we move from the premise of saying that this thing is a qualification, not a prohibition. You know, Chair, I'm reminded of, you remember the argument we went through when we were debating the the participation of the members of South Africa in the conflict zones, where we were saying that if somebody wants to participate, he must get a permission from the minister. I think if we are saying about this right, maybe it's why were we not challenged there? Then this, it's a person is allowed to choose or to go wherever he likes. But we put that so that it becomes a qualification if somebody wants to go and practice his profession in or her profession in the conflict zone. So I'm thinking here that same applies, that it is a qualification, that it has to be checked if somebody wants to, particularly because they are getting this life salary, that you give somebody life salary, but you don't want to be checked or whatever, because it's not that it's going to, she or she is going to refuse. It's only that when they do that, it has to be transparent what are they doing after retirement, particularly because they draw the salary from the state.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ntuli. I still want to hear someone who will try to say the submission by Judge Freeman does not cover the concerns that is there under Clause 11 as it is. one other argument that the judges told us yesterday is that the salary they are getting is for the job they have done before. That's what it's not pension or whatever. It's the state is thanking them for the work they've done before, which is the work they've done. Yeah. Now, can someone talk to this document and tell me if I take the views by my colleague and they all make sense, all of them. But I'm trying to get a middle ground here as to where the proposed amendment by Judge Christian, because to me it makes some sense. I want to see if because they're also closing the gap that yes, there must be permission, but they must be allowed to do some work without, unless if whatever. I'll come to the Dr. Miller submission. But I want to check if there are some loopholes in this proposed amendment, Johan and Rufiru, before as a because I don't think we'll finalize today. I can see that the member still wants to consult about this thing. So But if we're to finalize it today, let me not even go there, because I want us to finish this discussion so that we get a briefing about this judicial education institute bill. Who's going to do it? If I may check. Okay. I know we'll do it. But I want to talk to this submission, Johan. Let me hear your view on the submission.
Okay, thank you. What this submission boils down to is he seeks to introduce certain categories where you do not need to seek permission at all, and then there's still that catch-all where you must obtain prior consent by the minister acting in this instance in consultation with the Chief Justice. But those issues that he wants to put there as an automatic approval relates to alternative dispute resolution, occupying a judicial position in the country outside South Africa, acting as a commissioner in terms of the Commissions Act, Companies Act, or acting as a chairperson of a statutory body, or acting as an ombudsman. Now, these categories are, apart from the arbitrations, are really the arbitrary the categories where presently, and under the law as it stands at the moment, we get a lot of applications. So those are the issues. So this boils down to giving an automatic consent for that which presently is being given consent to in any event, and still leaving a catch-all for those instances where there are no consent to. And I think it comes back
to... If I can ask you, John, other than the one that is under the proposed 2, 11-2, other than those ones, which ones are they expected to ask anything for? Other than this one here, because...
If you want to take up a directorship of a company, for example, Chief, that might be an issue. Then there's, of course, the golden rule that nobody's mentioned. I thought about it yesterday. There's nothing in law, no rule in law that says you're now a retired judge. And we've heard how they've abandoned these ultra-lucrative practices to become judges. What is to prevent a judge who's retired from returning and set up a practice as a senior advocate? It's well accepted that you cannot do that, that it's not allowed. But there's nothing in law preventing a judge from doing that. And you can imagine for yourself, if I can use a bizarre example, if the former Chief Justice Arthur Chaskelson should now return to practice, what an incredible disadvantage that would have for litigants, etc. But those are the kinds of issues that you need to scope for to regulate.
But they argued that John, if you remember, they said before this current legislation was passed, when they joined the bench, this kind of provisions was not there. When they asked to ask permission, they said no, it was not even there.
There were some factual inaccuracies yesterday, which I thought not to reflect upon. But there's two things I can point out. An argument that we hear, and I say this with due respect, it's really a mute issue whether there is such a concept as a judge for life. It is true that it was introduced in 1989 under the former Justice Kobe Kutsi at the time. But remember when the interim constitution kicked in? The Constitutional Court was set up. It had a 7-year term for Constitutional Court judges. There was a special dispensation introduced for them to be remunerated during those 7 years in office. And after the 7 years, you had to abandon the office of Constitutional Judge, and then there was a specific gratification paid to those judges. No pension, no salary, once-off gratification. If I recall correctly, it might have been tax-free. I cannot vouch for that. Then the new constitution kicked in, and the term was extended to 12 years. Now, what the new constitution, well, the term of constitutional court judges was extended to 12 years. That 12 years necessitated, it influenced the formula that was used to calculate the gratification of a constitutional court judge upon retirement. And that's one of the principal reasons why they had to revisit the Judges Remuneration Act of 1989. What happened then? a whole new Judges Remuneration and Contributions of Employment Act was passed in 2001. It's Act 47 of 2001. So the historical fact is that dispensation introduced by Kobitsi was Pens and Poikis adopted in the new dispensation. That is why we still have this concept. It went further than that. It then drew the constitutional court judges into the system as well. No longer did they get a gratuity and a handshake upon leaving the constitutional court bench. Now they are also getting a salary in the same position as the other judges. So the fact is just that the system was carried over and it's now part of the new dispensation. And I need to reflect very briefly also that it's very difficult to compare judges as a category with any other categories, be it members of parliament, be it other professions, etc. We must always remember that when it comes to pension, you can only compare apples with apples and pears with pears. There's no pension fund contribution, firstly, in this instance. It is a salary, and whether it's theoretical or not, it's a salary. It says on the statute that you'll get the salary for life. And it is, as Mr. Msisi pointed out, it's continuously adjusted. It is always as if you are holding that office. It is a very, very unique dispensation. If I get appointed as a judge today, and the very next day I injure myself to such an extent that I must be boarded for medical reasons, so I might hold my office for one day, I am guaranteed a salary calculated as if I had held that office for 4 years minimum. And then should I fall away, that will also... the only point I'm making that it's a very, very unique dispensation. It's not fair to compare. See, but then, and I also didn't want to, half a minute, remember in Potchefstroom, we said, but the motivation, the rationale, and I think that's what the other commentators yesterday were getting at, for this qualification, can never be, or even perceived to be, getting back at judges because of their wonderful dispensation. That can never be the reason. There must be, and as I think Judge Friedman pointed out, a perceived mischief. And the mischief cannot be that they are having too good a dispensation. What the rationale for this legislation must be logical. It must make sense. It can never be to compensate for what is perceived as too good a dispensation. And the mischief to be sought to be addressed in this instance is simply this, and it can never be anything else than to protect the dignity of the judiciary and the courts. To really entrench the system, as I said just now, why a judge cannot return to practice as an advocate, etc. And if that rationale cannot be justified, then I must agree, then this will fail. I can point out in this applications that I've got here, even the former Chief Justice Chaskelson, we all know when he was appointed, made applications as well. Not for arbitration, but he... And in 2001, that Act of 2001 that I referred to, the New Judges Remuneration Act, that carried over the same limitation where those judges must apply. So it is not only in the 59 Act,
okay.
It's also
okay,
dealt
with. Okay, John. Now, the Office of the State Law Advisor, they are quiet, you know. And I want to hear them before I go to the field. Huh?
I think it would be very dangerous. I must be very cautious or apply my mind and look at the issue very carefully.
I'm aware you've been lobbied, Refilwe, but we're going to ambush that. Yeah, I'll come to you. Let them finish and I'll give you. Yes, sir.
thank you, Chair. I will speak to the amendment, but Chair, before I can speak to the amendment, can I try to respond to the issues that were raised about the law of general application? Chair, a law of general application doesn't mean that it has to apply to every single individual in South Africa. If it applies to a certain group, it has to apply to that group equally, meaning you can't have a law that's going to say black judges this, black, white judges this, or male judges this, female judges this. It has to apply to all the judges equally. And in that respect, it is a law of general application because it will be applying to judges generally. However, you can't say because judges who Johan has already said that they're very different category that you can't compare with any other category. You can't say because it applies to them, then it applies to every other profession. It wouldn't. This law says a judge, meaning only judges need to apply for permission from the minister, unless of course later on in life a similar legislation then comes for other professions. So you can't, based on this, say members of parliament, if they were to be required, then have to apply, because then there would have to be other legislation that requires them to do it. That, Chair. And as to the suggestion, Chair. From this, what seems to be, like again, Johannes has already said, they're trying to protect the administration of justice, the integrity of the administration of justice. And this suggestion or this amendment says we can ask for permission for anything else but arbitration, commissions and whatever else the judge is tabulating in this amendment. I'll take arbitration and again maybe tread on dangerous grounds. Look at the situation in the Cape Town bar. There is a real problem in the Cape Town bar where and maybe it's perception. Maybe it's not really reality, it's perception. But we always say we don't want only justice to be done but also to be seen to be done. And in the spirit of that, the let me call it perception in the Cape Bar, that the white advocates are in certain circumstances or instances looking at the court, the court role, look at who the judge is. If it's a black judge who is assumed to be incompetent, then it's either we get another date or we convince our client to go to arbitration. It could be a perception. It could be that it's not true. But let's take that circumstance where matters are being taken away from the administration of justice, from the court services, and are taken to arbitration, and you have judges. Now, the reality is the judges that are retiring or are being discharged are judges who have been active for some time and who have been in the system for long, and the reality is those judges are white. And that's the reality we just have to face. Who are now arbitrators? In terms of this amendment, they don't have to ask permission. They can just go and be arbitrators. And you have then the case by having the advantage of taking that.
No, I must seriously object what our researcher is doing now. I can't go along. Are we discussing rights or are we discussing this bill? If so, Chairperson, I would like to have your ruling.
Okay.
Because I can't sit here and listen to what she is saying, Chairperson.
Can I apologize for bringing the error issue? I do apologize for bringing the error issue because, Chair, it is a sensitive issue. But, Chair, at the same time, we do want to be realistic. We do have racial issues, and we do in the legal profession.
But it's because you
and
you,
I do apologize for doing this. And
no, it's because you know you qualified the by saying it might be a perception.
Yes.
You qualified it, but I think you should apologize.
I do apologize, and then I mean I don't mean to bring up this. It's a sensitive issue, and I'm aware of that. And I did say this is me saying it's a perception, but also wanting to say, we don't only want justice to be seen to be done, but there to be a perception that it is being done. And if that is the reality, you then have that problematic issue at the bar, which has the potential of affecting the integrity of the administration of justice. And if a judge can just be an arbitrator without asking for permission, then that continues. Whereas if the minister sees that there is a similar problem in terms of Levin, the minister can say, we have a problem there, and I will not, in this circumstance, in this instance, not give you permission. And it doesn't mean that in other circumstances, arbitration cannot, or a judge cannot be an arbitrator. That.
But a judge cannot be an arbitrator. It's a
retired
judge
can
be an arbitrator.
Just a minute, can we? At the end, colleagues, you're going to decide what you want in this bill. So be comfortable. Her position is a parliamentary legal advisor.
Advisor or researcher?
No. Advisor. Legal advisor for parliament, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not a researcher. Our researcher is Pat here. I'll ask her to speak at some point. It's Patricia. Yeah, but thanks to Philip for that. I'm glad that you qualified your statement by saying it might be a perception. Not that she's saying that's what's happening. It's a perception that has been reported widely. I'm going to allow my colleagues to talk to this thing, and we're going to adjourn this discussion. This thing is very... Now, the Makulu boss in the office of the state law advisor is here, you know. Yeah, now. Now you can brief him, you can brief him. Things are hot here. Just that the aircon is not enough, so things are hot. Dr. Fanyede wanted to speak first, followed by Honorable Leroux, and then Honorable Van der Merwe, you wanted to say something? Okay. Then Mr. Manyosi and Honorable Mac.
Chairperson, I don't think we should speculate about perceptions here in this committee. I think we are here to consider the amendment and to consider the bill before us. If we can start elaborating on the way our parliamentary advisor is, Chairperson, I can keep you busy for the rest of the day. But I don't think that's... I will refrain from that because I don't think that's our purpose here today. I just want to make this remark. Thank you.
Okay. Again, Honourable West.
Yes, Chair, I think we're having a political input here, not a discussion on what is going on here. This is a total political... It's turned now into a political thing, which we were hoping wasn't going to be the case. And yes, I think we must get off the subject and let it cool down for a while, and then we can come back to it later on. Thanks, Chair.
Colleagues, in this committee, the history of this committee, whatever we're doing, we put aside politics and do the mission. That's what we're known for. That's why the NSOP is very proud of this committee, because we don't play the man, but play the ball. But I'm not protecting Urifile, but she was saying, because you remember that even in newspapers, and it was reported widely, this thing of the Cape situation. So it's not what she's starting to raise now. It's raised, it might be a perception, or it might be true, it might be not true, but that's what people are saying. But we're not here for that. I agree with you, colleagues. So I'm just citing an example. I'm not trying to protect her, but she was just reporting that there's that perception. But I don't want to be bogged down to that. We're having a serious issue to decide on, colleagues. The bill we're busy with now, and even the Arab bill that is still coming. But let me recognize the Velem before I...
No, Chairman, I agree with what's now been said. I hate it if we bring politics in, and if we're going to hide behind saying it's a perception, I can say the most horrible thing. I can say white judges are useless and black judges are very good. It's a perception. I'm not really saying it's a perception. Then I say the most horrible thing. We can't behind the fact saying it's a perception. I'm very sorry about that. But what I would like to know is the NA took 7 years to get to this point. And I think we must give ourselves time. It must cool down. This committee has a very good record of doing the right thing. I think we need a cooling down period. We need to study study this himself. And when we come back, we start deliberating again. Thank you.
I said I recognize Honorable Manyosi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, let me take the issue that you raised about the retirement payment to judges being equivalent to the salary they were receiving. Chairperson, there, the judge, I don't know whether it was the judge or Advocate Hoffman who said that, but he advanced no basis at all for the argument that the full salary is to make up for the shortfall during the time that they were in active service. He advanced no ground for saying so, no basis at all. There was no basis. There is nothing that he showed us that when they leave service, they are discharged. It is said that we will pay you the same salary, the same whatever pension as we were paying you a particular level of salary. So there is no basis for that argument that it is making up for a shortfall. Not at all. Again, we will find problems trying to delete in totality Section 11. Because as this departmental legal advisor has suggested, although he says tacitly judges are not allowed to move to the level of the bar, but the fact is that does happen. But also there is a potential if we say it must be removed totally for them to want to become advocates again, using the constitutional right in the event of them being prohibited of unfair discrimination. And on the other hand, if this is unregulated by legislation, there would be unfair competition because there would be nothing to bar them from going to the bar. Nothing at all would bar them from going to the bar. And there would be that conflict between these rights. And therefore, it is quite difficult to strike off in its entirety, Section 11. That is my contribution.
Thanks, M. But maybe to even put things exactly what judges said. They said no, they're only talking to 11, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
They're not saying they must strike all of it completely. They're talking to 11, 2, and 3 only. So that's why they want to make some changes. What are we rooted on?
Thank you, Jay. Now, there's only one issue for me, Jay. And that is an issue that I think we are not looking at. I need to be advised, and the legal advisors are here. And that is about, this goes about the constitutionality of 11, Clause 11. Because that is the threat, that if it is passed, it will not be constitutional. So, we need to be advised, is it constitutional, is it not constitutional? And to gain that. On that, I can make a decision. Because the supreme law of this country is our constitution. And we have to abide by what that constitution says. That will make my decision easier. And then this other point, you see, judges, and I agree, are definitely in a different category. But we must have a certain set of rules in one circumstance and another set of rules in another circumstance. When it comes to openness, you don't want to submit to openness because it might, even as our learned colleague says, you might damage a judge's image. But when it comes to salaries and remuneration, then there's a different setup. You see, so things might, if the law of generalizing, that applies, then we must first go to and see that when a judge is retired and is no more judge, then he's a natural human being and a normal person like I am. And then he's subjected to all those laws that I am subjected to. And your profession, any profession that you have, is guided by a set of rules. No profession, irrespective, even if you are a council worker, there's a set of rules or there's limitations. But that limitations must be justified by that constitution. So the constitutionality of all of this, that is what is crucial to me. If Clause 11 can be justified by the constitution, then why? If we then fight it, we are fighting against the constitution. If it is unconstitutional, then we must find a way to make it constitutional, to revisit what this judge has proposed, because what Judge Friedman proposes is he's taken certain aspects out. He's taken all these, he's taken 11-2, and he says, no, that's all right. That is constitutional. That we will agree with, but we don't agree with 3. So I sense with them, they disagree among themselves on 11, because the Hoffman said, scrap the whole 11. While the judges say, we'll agree with 11-2, but we don't agree with 11-3. If you look at this proposal, this is what it says. It accepts a part of Clause 11, but it doesn't accept the other part. So when does the first part, where did this become constitutional, and where did 11-3? It's not constitutional. And that is my whole argument. It's about the constitutionality. And if we make a decision and it is challenged in court and we are proved wrong, then we're in trouble. So the cut for me is the constitutionality. And the legal advisors must really assist us here and go in depth about this. Because at the end of the day, I must make a decision that will be justified by the Constitution and nothing else. Nothing else will defer my decision. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks very much, Honourable Mac. Colleagues, I'll call for CAM. I'll call for the cessation of hostility. I'll call for peace in this committee. Now, we. I want us to go and look at, as referred by the presenters, the Section 2 of our Constitution, Section 32, Section 36, in that order. And people must advise us exactly as those provisions. I'll come to you, Honorable. But I thought the last speaker on this thing would be Honorable Mzuzu, and then he will consider what I said now, my appeal to the committee. Let's not tarnish the record of this committee. We've been doing so well up until now. Why come here and drum all of it? We come here and drum. Madam,
thank you, Chairperson. The Chairperson, probably it's unfortunate that we have now traveled on the wrong terrain. But be as it may, Chairperson, I always find it very necessary that there are questions that we can pursue as politicians and ruffle feathers. But when we put questions to the department personnel and any other people who are not politicians, if we persist, we will in that way bring them to a state where they will have to now respond politically. because they are now in the country. Try, by trying to get out of, hey, is that not AK-47? Okay. But by trying to respond to what we want as politicians, it will always be a problematic. I have seen that in the past, and I would appeal that whenever there are questions that we can reserve. But I think she did not go there because she wanted. You see, right from the onset, the statement says, by the presenter, what are you hiding?
I just appeal that the cessation of hostility, calling for peace, for calm, now we are busy rattling feathers. Because what you're doing, I know Avelem will respond, Frank will respond, and let's leave it for now. Let's flag it for now. You can talk on another issue, but
can I end with this?
Don't call the figure.
Okay.
We'll come at it.
Let me end it this way, sir. I think you said, cool down, let's leave this river. It's over flooding. Probably when it ebbs, we can probably start talking. But I would add with the Afrikaans word. Ag ons miskien vandag kan ons bietjie gaan gor oor hierdie geleentheid. Then we'll find each other.
Wat is dit?
Gor. So bietjie gaan gor.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. Even Raffel Feder is assisting the process. No. I want to refill. I saw your hand up. Please, okay, Rutera.
I just wanted to apologize again. I didn't mean to offend the committee, and I didn't mean to disturb the peace of the committee. I was using that, okay, but just as an example, it's not to say it's true or it's not true. I don't know, I'm not practicing it, but I was using it as an example, and I apologize if my example offended members of the committee. It wasn't my intention, and I definitely didn't intend to discuss politics. I'm very weak in that respect. I wouldn't want to go there. Thank you, Chair.
Accepted.
Can I just make one remark? Chairperson, just one thing, and that is if a retired judge after 15 years or 20 years on the bench starts a practice, an advocate gets instructed by attorneys. If you're out of circulation, I speak from experience, Chairperson, it takes a while for you to get your feet back and get your relations back with attorneys. So I just want to make this remark. And that's one thing to be a judge, it's another thing to be a practitioner. There's a big difference, Chairperson.
I just will comment on the comment by Refilwe.
Yeah.
I thought you want to say something about apologizing for...
I've indicated to her without... No, thank you, Chairperson. I've indicated to her that, of course, I accept that. I do, Chairperson. No, thank you.
Thank you. On that peace note, that's a wonderful note. I won't even give Johan to say anything about this thing. I want us now to go to the... We are stopping discussion on this bill now. Yeah, we'll go and consult. We'll go to some bilaterals with our colleagues, other parties. So that when we meet tomorrow, because what I'm trying to do, colleagues, we're supposed to meet on Friday, but what I know, Friday is some other thing. I'm not saying anything, but I have bring forward our meeting tomorrow at 2. So that the Friday there's no meeting. But if you want us to continue on Friday, I'm fine. We can meet on Friday. We don't meet tomorrow. Oh, let me check other parties. From the ruling party, there's no caucus tomorrow. I wonder if there's no caucus, we can meet in the morning so that in the afternoon we're free. Can we do that? Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Then Let's meet tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to meet to continue discussions on the two bills. The one just flagged and the one we're going to be briefed in a few seconds.
We start at 9 o'clock because we booked on flights and things like that.
Is there any person who is opposed to the proposed 9?
I would rather...
Aye, Johan.
Yes, Chairperson, 8:30, because I'm booked on another.
No,
Frank,
don't
press
me.
Yeah, can we do it at 9? Can we confirm the venue before we adjourn today? Can... top management will assist in.
When you think?
Yeah. Maybe before we adjourn, we might be lucky to get the exact V. No, it's V 454.
It was
on Friday, right? Yeah, let's check tomorrow where I can meet. So that we.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, there's another question. At what time are we going to finish off tomorrow?
Yeah.
There's another big question.
We might finish at 5, you know.
But on a serious note, we'll see how far we can go. With the permission, colleagues, I think let's thank the department for really taking all the trouble and explaining some of these difficult provisions. This thing is so controversial. The bill has got so many clauses, but the only clause that seems to be holding us back is this one. The other ones about the openness and whatever, that one I think we'll get around it. I don't see it's a problem. Now, can I now request Johan to talk to us about the corner in the crazy. Who took my bill now? Yeah, we are now dealing with the South African Judicial Education Institute bill. Without any waste of time, I will request Mr. Dilange to address us on this bill. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, just as an aside, I've given to your committee manager a copy for members' benefit about that Canadian thing that they can just have a look at it and contemplate on. That deals with whether the public should have access to the disciplinary proceedings, etc. That's just to assist members, Chair. Chair, then with regard to this South African Judicial Education Institute Bill, I must firstly sincerely apologize for the fact that it is not a complicated piece of legislation and it is not sensitive at all, and that there was apparently major consensus both in the other house and among all stakeholders with regard to the content of this legislation. Although it had not always been the case. Chair, the bill emanates from the recommendations of a committee that was set up some time ago by a previous minister under the auspices of the Canada-South Africa Linkage Project, which looked at judicial education, and the committee eventually made a report and recommended that, and I quote, we believe the best would be to convert the Justice College, that is the existing Justice College, into an independent statutory institution publicly funded but controlled by a prestigious council chaired by the Chief Justice or his nominee, and with members drawn from all the main interested bodies, the higher and lower judiciary, the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission, the Ministry, the Advocates and Attorneys Professions, the Department, University Teachers of Law, and the National Prosecuting Authority. Just to stop for a while, I think members who are not familiar with the existing structure should just know that we've had a Justice College for since time immemorial, it seems. It was in Pretoria, and it gave training to mostly magistrates, not aspirant magistrates, but people who were already magistrates, went on refresher courses there. At some stage, it was also used extensively to prepare people, magistrates, for appointment to the regional courts bench. It also gave training to prosecutors, and it also gave training in respect of disciplinary matters or all quasi-judicial matters to other public servants. It was a well-known institution. It is still functioning today, but as a result of a healthy tension that's developed since 1994, when the lower courts, amongst others, were for the first time recognized as also forming part of the judicial authority of the country, the powers that be were forced to look into the principles surrounding judicial planning, etc. And college, as we will see later, is quite remarkable, markedly affected by the proposals contained in this legislation. Now, members were probably also aware that in April 2005, there was a judicial colloquium hosted by Minister Mabandla. At the time, there was quite some negative reports about a package of legislation and dealing with so-called transformation of the judiciary. Included was a Constitution 13th Amendment Bill. The Superior Courts Bill formed part of that. This Judicial Service Commission Amendment Bill that we've just dealt with, as you see, the contentious nature comes a while back already. And, of course, there was a South African National Justice Training College, Sunchuck Bowl, it was called at the time. And there were extensive discussions at that colloquium, where after a so-called advisory committee on judicial education was requested to put the matter on the agenda, and the committee... On this committee were judges, magistrates, the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission, the Justice Ministry, the Director General, the General Counsel of the Bar, the Law Society of South Africa, the National Prosecuting Authority, various magistrates' organizations, as well as Justice College and the Society of Law Deans of South Africa. This advisory committee eventually put forward a draft bill, and it was submitted to the minister. It was subsequently refined. And eventually, after approval by Cabinet, it was introduced, and it is really the bill that is now before this committee. The bill essentially makes provision for a South African Judicial Education Institute to be established as a juristic person with a mandate for the judicial education and training of judicial officers and aspiring judicial officers. Of course, judicial officers in this context include all judicial officers, both judges and magistrates. The governance of this institute will rest in a council consisting of representatives of all the interested parties and role players, as well as two persons from the public who are not involved in the administration of justice. The institute will have the object to provide proper, appropriate, and transformational judicial education and training, having due regard to both our inherited legacy and our new constitutional dispensation, and secondly, to offer judicial education and training to aspiring and newly appointed judicial officers, as well as continued training for experienced judicial officers. Chair, and with your leave, I know I circulated a little document that I've been using, but I think we can go straight to the bill itself. Of course, all the document does further on is just referring to the various clauses. As members can see, there is a preamble. I do not know if you would like to look at the preamble right now. Maybe members can look at that at their leisure. The first clause is definitions. It's very, very obvious and standard. I don't need to refer to that. I've just referred to the objects of the Act, the fact that in clause 3 we're establishing the Institute. Clause 4, just saying that the seat of the Institute must be determined by the Council with the concurrence of the Minister, but already... we've identified, I think, it's right next to the Constitutional Court. It will be on the same premises as the Constitutional Court. But, of course, they can conduct its the Institute can conduct its activities away from the seat. The functions, as clause 5, are really straightforward. They establish, develop, maintain, provide judicial education and professional training for judicial officers, to provide entry-level education and training, as well as to enhance suitability for appointment to judicial officers, to judicial office rather. proceed to conduct research into judicial education and related matters. D, promote through education and training the quality and efficiency of services provided in the administration of justice. E, promote the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility and effectiveness of the courts. F, to render such assistance to foreign judicial institutions and courts as may be agreed upon by the council. Then six, just the establishment of the council that will govern the institute. Seven, rather importantly, deals with the composition of the council. The council will consist of the minister or his or her nominee, a judge of the constitutional court designated by the chief justice, a judge or any other person designated by the judicial service commission from among its ranks, the president of the Supreme Court of Appeal, two judges president and two other judges, at least one of whom must be a woman, designated by the Chief Justice, five magistrates designated by the Magistrates Commission, of whom at least two must be women and two must be regional court magistrates, a judge who has been discharged from active service as contemplated in the Judges Remuneration Conditions of Employment Act, the director of the institute, one advocate designated by the General Council of the Bar of South Africa, one attorney designated by the Law Society, two university teachers of law, and two other members who must be members of the public, not involved in the administration of justice, designated by the Minister after consultation with the Chief Justice. I think what's important in this regard is to remark or to note that the majority of the council will be judicial officers. And the council is the main decision-making body of this institute, and as we will see later, they determine the curricula, everything. So it's very important to note that the governance of the institute is really in the hands of the judiciary. The council, obviously there must be other representatives on the council. Sub 2 there just deals with the terms of office, vacancies, and 5, I want to draw attention to sub 5 there, due consideration must be given in the composition of the council to demographic and gender representativity. I deal with the meetings of the council. It's not necessary to refer to that, Chair. In terms of 9, there will be standing committees established by the council, and each standing committee will have a particular area of responsibility. Those areas are curriculum planning and development, oversight of judicial education, budget and finance, personnel management, and general administration. Then, of course, the council may also appoint an executive committee, which must be chaired by the Deputy Chief Justice, and further standing committees or other committees for particular purposes when it becomes necessary or if it becomes necessary. The members of standing committees must be members of the council, but they may also opt other people. Chair 10 is the powers and duties of the council. It's really just that the council must do all that is necessary and expedient to achieve the objects of the Act. They may acquire, alienate movable, immovable property, hire and let movable, immovable property. They must oversee the appointment of staff. They must engage in research into matters affecting the institute. And they must also establish and maintain contact with the Judicial Service Commission, the Magistrates Commission, the heads of courts, the organized legal profession, academics, and other individuals and entities with an interest in judicial education. Then, in order to perform the functions, the institute must employ a director, who is the administrative head of the institute. They must employ academic staff and procure the services of suitably qualified judicial educators, employ administrative staff, and they can enter into contracts with service providers and accept liability for expenses incurred as a result of such services being rendered. 12 deals with the appointment of the director, who will be, as I've said, the administrative head of the council, of the institute rather. They must appoint a director for a determined term and on the conditions that the council may determine. The director may be reappointed. And as the administrative head and chief executive officer of the institute, this director is responsible for the general administration of the institute and manage and direct the activities, appoint and supervise the administrative staff, provide quarterly management reports to the director general of justice. And the minister must, with the concurrence of the council and after consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine the director's remuneration, allowances, benefits, and other terms and conditions of employment. 13, finances and accountability. It's a stock standard provision we find in bills of this nature, Chair. Deals with the expenditure in connection with the administration and functioning of the institute, how it must be voted for, and that the Director General of Justice will be the accounting officer of this institute. 14, the remuneration of staff. The council may, with the concurrence of the minister, who must consult with the Minister of Finance, determine the remuneration, allowance, benefits, other terms and conditions of employment of each member of staff. 15 deals with an annual report, which must be prepared by the council and submitted to the minister. Sets out some of the things that must be included in the report. 3, the minister, I'm referring to 15.3, I thought it might be interesting to the committee, the minister must table in the National Assembly each annual report submitted in terms of this act. 16 is guidelines that the Chief Justice may issue with the concurrence of the minister in respect of any matter concerning the exercise of powers and functions of the institute. 17 is just reimbursement of members of the council. They're not reimbursed really, but they're not remunerated, but they may be reimbursed for expenditure. Reasonable expenses incurred in the course of their services as members of the council. 18 says that there will be a seal for the institute, and the president must approve this seal and it must be published in the Gazette. 19 is the transitional provisions, they're rather important. It says that the institute must commence with its training functions as from a date fixed by the minister by notice in the Gazette. And 2, before the date so fixed, the necessary arrangements must be made for the institute to be accommodated, equipped and staffed in order to perform its functions properly. 20, just a short title and commencement. Just to return very briefly to the transitional arrangements, Chair, in other words, what is envisaged is the Act will be put into operation, but then there will be sufficient time and to ensure that on a certain date the Council or the Institute will actually commence with its functioning of educating judicial officers. In the meanwhile, magistrates are still on an ad hoc basis attending certain courses at the existing Justice College, and there are no structures in place presently for judges and judicial training. It is really matters that's being administratively dealt with by the Chief Justice acting with the concurrence of the minister, and in some instances, although that exercise has now been terminated, but earlier with that Canadian-South Africa link that we referred to earlier in the presentation, Chair. Chair, and that in a nutshell is this bill.
Wow. That was sweet. That was cool. Now, let me quickly, before I allow members to ask general questions, because today the purpose is this, the first briefing where we can ask any question in general. But let me throw the first salvo, that's the thing that I'm not used to. Usually I allow members to ask questions, but let me, this one. Let me draw attention to the provision of clause 13 on page 6. I want to read. Expenditure in connection with the established administration and function of the institute must be defrayed from monies appropriated by Parliament for this purpose. Are we together, colleagues?
Yeah.
Good. Now, I want us to read this with clause 15.3. It reads, the minister must table in the National Assembly each annual report submitted in terms of this act. So Parliament, that includes NCOP, where to appropriate monies for this to work. But the annual report must be tabled only in the National Assembly. That's stupid. That's very silly. Some people, you know what? Anyway, I'm not trying to ruffle feathers. But this one already must prepare some amendment to this, Johan. That's to prepare some amendment to this clause before I even consult my colleagues. This is unacceptable. If our colleagues are so greedy, they think they are the only parliament. Yeah. Parliament consists of 2 houses. Yeah. So we must give them money to work, but we must not know about the reports of what they are doing.
Chairperson,
I'm going to move back to the previous bill because there's exactly in clause 12 a similar provision excluding the NCOP and providing that the citizen report must be submitted only to the NA. I kept back from, but as you raise the issue now here, we have a similar situation. I do not have the bill before me, but I do remember that I picked it up. There's a similar provision in the previous bill, the contentious one, which we will be discussing tomorrow. If you just be alert about that, because I'm going to withdraw tomorrow sometime for my flight. Just want to fly a flag the item work too. Okay, to flag it.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Now, I think that was a wonderful briefing with the briefing note that makes it even nice easy for us. That clarifies all the provisions. Thanks very much, Johan, for this briefing. That was dynamic. Colleagues, let me open the floor now. Let's discuss this provisions. Honorable White.
Chair, yes, I'm coming back to Advocate Delana's briefing here. It's not quite 100% correct. There was a lot of blood on the floor of this in the NA. I've got it written down here because the rest is all whiffle waffle. What it comes down to is parts of the left, the juicy bits, is under the preamble, the rapid transformation of the judiciary, and then transformation of the judiciary. You see, it depends how you present things and what you leave out. You see, the rest is all just, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I just want to point that out.
Thank you, Jefferson. Jefferson, one would probably would want to know. I know the issue of the Justice College has been there for quite a while when I was still a member of the Magistrate Commission. There was a lot of queries. A lot of magistrates actually complain about who was sent to the what's name to the Justice College, and if you were not in those books of certain individuals, you would not be sent to the Justice College. And it has actually raised concern. Now, what is the intention? Do they want to outsource it, or is it still going to be run the same way as it was run? Because I know that it has done quite a lot of things. Even the interpreters now, it is another wing that has actually been put in the Justice College where they are also being trained. Now, one would like to know, I can see that they try to bring something or to try to revive it. Are they going to outsource it? It will be run by who? Who is going to be the person now in charge? In order that probably one knows exactly how it will be independent rather than depending on those who decide who is going for the training and who is not going for the training. But the other aspect is that there is a training that has now been going on. I know that Judge Ngobo, Judge Ngobo, is the one now going around addressing the aspirant magistrate, those who would probably be, would want to go into the bench. Now, whether that function is also linked with this because he's moving around as a sort of a roving and going to various places, what is the relationship with that function and this Justice College then?
Yeah, you remember that even in the colloquium at Captain Parker, as you rightly said, the judges were very angry that they don't want the involvement of the minister here because they want it to be a college where judiciary must be in charge completely. You know. So, but I can see there's water down now accommodative. Honorable Manus.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there is an element of desiring to transform the judiciary. And I see here that on the council, we have got about 17 legal eagles and two ordinary people drawn from the public. What is the criteria for selecting the members from the public, because my view is that the judiciary cannot of itself transform itself. I think the judiciary can only be transformed by the views of the public that it serves. And if you have got only two members from the public versus 17 highly qualified legal people. Now the tendency, natural or otherwise, is that people who are lay persons, because people do not want lay men, as if human has got no men. Lay persons are sometimes reluctant to debate with legal gurus. And if you have got only two people against 17 here, the deliberations by the council may be in favor of what the judiciary wants and not what the public wants in terms of what is produced by the institute. Thank you.
I thought you'd say, why are we not including traditional leaders here? I thought you'll come to this.
Sorry.
Any other question, Honorable Ntuli?
Chairperson, you will pardon me if the question has been asked. I was seeing there, which is number 7Q, where it says the minister must table in the National Assembly. Why not Parliament? I'm not sure whether that has been asked, but I just wanted to check that one. Why is it not tabled to Parliament? Why to the National Assembly? Thank you.
Yeah. Now, great minds in Pemba think alike.
Oh.
Yours truly throw the first elbow, that one.
Okay.
Clause 5F on page 3, clause 5F. I thought this is normal, but why are we putting it here where we'll even assist the foreign judicial institutions and courts? Are we compelled to do that? Any reason why are we ready? Because I thought it's normal. If they want an assistance, they will request, they will do that. Maybe there might be a reason why are we specifying it. This the composition of this council, I didn't do the calculations, but the Honorable Manus had done the calculations. 17 and on. Yeah, it's a big number. Yeah, maybe let's allow Johan to respond to this question.
Thank you very much, Chair. With regard to the issue of Parliament, or that the tabling should be in Parliament and not only in the National Assembly, I've noted that, Chair, and I will prepare an amendment for you. I must say I cannot really speak on behalf of powers that be on why it is like that. Then, Justice College, yes, it is envisaged that the present Justice College will remain. Although I do not have first-hand knowledge of it or experience of it, I do know that they are, in fact, preparing legislation just to deal with the status of the remainder of Justice College, which will now be focusing on
the training of prosecutors, heavy involvement from the National Prosecuting Authority, other areas of training in judicial and quasi-judicial areas, not judicial areas, but where justice issues come to mind, like promotion of administrative justice, disciplinary hearings, all those kind of things that's always on the agenda of public institutions and government organs of state in the functioning thereof. As Mr. Mcizi pointed out, interpreters will be a main or large function of that college, but just to summarize it, there is work now in the pipeline to formalize and build up the structure of the System Justice College. But as you've remarked, Chair, the judges did say at the colloquium that they cannot be seen to be entering the same building as civil servants, and we are now addressing that issue. Is the layperson's issue, Chair? I'm not too sure that I can really expand too much on that. We must just bear in mind that transformation of the judiciary in this instance obviously does not relate to demographics or anything like that. It relates to a mindset, it relates to the jurisprudential changes that have been introduced or that result from our transition to a constitutional democracy in 1994. And I think I need not elaborate on the fact that most of us who were legally qualified before that would have realized that there's been such a change. I mean, the law that you studied and the degrees that you obtained really became obsolete from 1994. You had to retrain yourself to align it with the whole constitutional or the new constitutional framework. So in that sense, and also with regard, of course, to the sense of the introduction of Chapter 2, the fundamental rights, etc., there's a lot of retraining, re-education that probably should occur in those fields. Obviously, it cannot be done by any persons other than judicial officers for the obvious reasons of independence of the judiciary, and we should not want to be seen or even to create a perception that there's any attempt to influence the judiciary. I think that is also the reason why this council is mainly in the hands of the judiciary. So with regard to the two members, I think they are there for reasons of accountability, so that at least the public have some sort of representation. But on the other hand, of course, the advocate and the attorney are really also representatives from the public sector. So personally, I must say I've had a bit of difficulty to see the exact role of these two members, because this institute is so much education focused. So a lay person can by definition really not contribute to transformational education of judicial officers. Because if you can do that in a legal context, how can you be a lay person? I'm not too sure if members follow that argument. But so I think the representation here is more than anything about accountability, rather than the fact that they have a lay person's perspective to add. But that's for the committee, obviously, to deliberate on that. G5F, you've referred to 5F, that it relates to the systems. I think, yeah, the reason was mainly just to ensure that you have a legal sanction, because this is a publicly funded institute. It is budgeted for in Parliament, but under F, they may use that money outside of the borders of the country or spend it in a manner that's not directed to South Africa, and you can only do that, as I understand, if you are legally sanctioned, if it's allowed by law. And this just makes sure that there cannot be any questions whether they can actually spend the money in that manner as well. So I think that covered the first one.
Is the Honourable Ntuli, Honourable Mzizi?
Thanks, Jefferson. I'm not sure whether I thought you, when Manyosi was contributing, you added the traditional leaders. Now, because I believe they form part, as you know, that they've got their traditional courts. And then if they are not included in this, it seems as if they will not be represented. I mean, can we get an advice on that one? Thanks.
Thank you, Reverend Tudy.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question would probably be on the issue of quasi-judicial, whether does it also include the traditional leaders in a sense. If it does, then I would not pursue it further. I would probably like to know what it entails, the quasi-judicial. Now, the main thrust of the of this question, why I wanted to know whether it has been outsourced, is that the agency has frankly refused to go to us and to the Justice College and said, who is going to train me? They were against that, now who is going to train them, other than probably themselves. As Joanne, you'd remember that we had actually tried to canvass widely, we even gone to other judges in other countries to find out whether they do submit themselves to a training. But in South Africa, it has been a problematic. How did how are the judges perceiving this? Who will be then the tutors in the what's name in that administration, where judges will also willingly to attend to these inductional courses or whatever?
Thank you very much. You may respond now, John.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, if you'll bear with me, I'll ask for an opportunity just to take up this issue of the traditional leaders with my principals to establish exactly what the policy in that regard is. To the best of my knowledge, let me just find out exactly where we stand on that, because I know that there's this other legislation that's presently in the pipeline as well. But that is later. This act actually predates that quite substantially. I need to see if there's any correlation between the two. Chair, then, yes, to Mr. Musidi's question, to answer to that, feedback we've had is that I think it's general knowledge that there's been initial resistance from certain quarters in the judiciary, but since the model has been developed, especially after the colloquium, and there's been more deliberations between the judiciary on this issue, there's really a general acceptance now, both for the need for an institution such as this and the need for further judicial training on certain areas. I don't think that's it's not contentious anymore, Jim.
From the judging award thing.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow that, Chair. I'm not too sure what exactly you're doing at the moment.
My understanding, he is now going around various quarters, addressing the issues of the aspirant magistrate who would like to go to the bench, how should they prepare the argument, and all of that, and for the appeal, and all those things. If he's engaged on that, is it not going to be something that can be addressed at the
In fact, Jay, that is being done presently administratively, but it's not in terms of any statutory framework, but those kind of issues will certainly be dealt with under the umbrella of this institute once it is established.
From where I'm seated, it's clear that this might be one of those easiest bills we're going to pass. I wouldn't be surprised if we pass it tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised. And colleagues must come ready with all the questions tomorrow. Because we might go the formal stage. And if there are no questions that might ask me to go and consult my parliamentary legal advisor to consult them, to give me the advice, and the Office of the State Law Advisor to consult them to see if there might be some major changes. But if not, we might pass it tomorrow, but with your permission, of course. Any other question? I think this was clear. We can stop it just here.
Yeah, on that note, thanks, honorable, honorable colleagues, for the for this, and to your hand. Thank you very much for this briefing. You see, there are no questions on this one. It's yeah. Now, tomorrow, we might start with this one. We might start with this one tomorrow. We might start with this one. Yeah, that's the thing. If we are able to finish it, then we'll get to the other one.
Yes, I wonder, as I first leave earlier, I would like to have some other, you know, input as well, if necessary. I don't want to abide by your ruling, but if we start with this one, I've got no objections against this one, unless we finish quickly with this one, because I can't leave later than 4:15 tomorrow. I would still like to have some input in the other one, if we should start with the other one, but if I'm in your answer, maybe this one is not going to take long, then at least I can make some other. If you would recognize me first when we get to the other one, then you'd be aware of what I might mean. Just a remark here, because I don't want to object against your ruling. Whatever you decide tomorrow will be fine.
Colleagues, Dr. Van Herten, the Honorable, is giving notice that tomorrow, when we discuss the other bill, he wants to be the first speaker. And I'm agreeing to this. I don't need any seconder. The ruling. No, I'm proposing to start with this one because I think we'll be dealing with this one. Really. But unless it's after consulting the principal, you might come with some other view. But if not, I think this one we can pass it. Yeah. Now, about tomorrow's meeting, it's good to, in the meeting, to have the top management with us. They were able to deal with some of these serious challenges of venue. So she managed to get the venue for us, V226. That is for Domain. That is Bulelwa for Domain. She has done wonderful. No headache. Venue 226. The V, yeah. V 226. I don't know what name. Now, the lunch is served at 90 Plain. At that restaurant, corner down there. It used to be something I told also.